envisaged in the mandate was a very significant step. I mean, most nations had made their commitment of troops, and bearing in mind that a lot of nations were making commitments to the United Nations for the first time in their history, most of them had made their commitments on the basis that this was going to be a pure peacekeeping activity and that everybody would comply with the agreements that they'd made in Paris. So it was a huge step to contemplate. And let me say, it was never a sort of a clear-cut decision. One day we were going along with the mandate that was given to us on the basis of the agreements, and the next day we moved to another mandate. We gained resolutions from the Security Council that supported us in our endeavours, and the Security Council continued to exhort the Khmer Rouge to fulfil their obligations to the process. But at a point in time, it was clear that the military either had to change its complete set of dispositions to one based on an insecure environment, or sustain the, or leave, really. And don't forget, we were actually halfway through with respect to the other factions, the implementation of the other mandate. And there's a real dilemma. I mean, on one hand, we had a posture and a structure which was designed for the cantonment and disarmament process, which was supposed to be an orderly process. And on the other hand, we were foreseeing the need to be able to support an electoral process in a non-secure environment. These two things demand different different military outlook and a different military posture. But at one stage, around about September 1992, it became clear that we had to contemplate a change in the dispositions and indeed in the plans for the sustainment of the military force. I began planning with my staff in great depth for that outcome, and began to go through a process of convincing Akashi, the special representatives of the Secretary General, and the permanent representatives of the Permanent Five and other players in Cambodia that we actually could do this, that the environment would allow us to comprehend running the election in a non-secure environment if we changed our dispositions, and we gained a commitment from the various nations to this end. So I was involved in continually briefing all of those people as we made our plans, once our plans were completed, it was a massive undertaking to move the whole force in what was actually a large clockwise movement around the countryside, so that we ended up with a very strong structure around the outside of the most insecure areas in the country. So the question of who made these decisions, it wasn't made as an overnight decision. The decision was made that we should proceed from our previous focus to the focus on the conduct of the elections, but sustaining the original focus and sustaining the opportunities for everybody to comply with the original focus, but getting ourselves into a position where in the event that we're unable to get that compliance, we could actually conduct, we could sustain the conduct of an election in that environment. There came a critical moment where it was go, no go. The question was whether we were going to proceed to the election without the Khmer Rouge. And that was a decision which had to be made early in 1993. And when the decision was made, of course, we were able to throw our weight more clearly and more closely behind the civil components and run the election.
And what was your perspective on the confrontation between Sihanouk and UNTAC when Sihanouk demanded that UNTAC put an end to the so-called climate of violence engendered by the Khmer Rouge?
Well, Sihanouk knew that somewhere in the process, where he had been head of the CGDK in the early stages of the negotiation, he must have made promises to all the factions. I suppose he saw this as his role as a conciliator and the head of Cambodians' views of the future. And clearly he had made promises to the Khmer Rouge about the atmosphere and the possibilities which would be created once he was back in Phnom Penh. And it was clear that Hun Sen and the state of Cambodia were not going to comply with the circumstances which would allow him to fulfil those promises. In his frustration, he waxed and waned in his criticism of parties on all sides of this process. The fact that the Khmer Rouge were not going to comply with his desires and began to actually conduct acts of terror around the countryside to frighten the international community, I think really exposed the weaknesses of Sihanouk's position in this process. And when he spoke about the UNTAC putting an end to the climate of violence, he wasn't really speaking about us going out and doing away with the Khmer Rouge. He was speaking about us in a very frustrated way, about us producing a solution which he'd actually promised to everybody, which was not actually, we were not actually capable of producing. It's a complex issue, but you have to understand that Sihanouk was unable to meet the desires of all the Cambodian factions and was often quite critical to the international players in this about the fractious nature of the Cambodian people. But also he was very clear about their tendency towards violence and the fearful things that could happen if we didn't find some compromises in this process.
What is your assessment of the success or failure of the cantonment of weapons and the extent to which the factions cooperated in this process?
Well, let me say the two smaller factions, the KP, KPNIF, and ANCI, the military arm of Phung Chin Phek, complied as fully as they could. I mean, they had nothing to gain by the process not going through fully. And in fact, we actually had to let them rearm themselves again when we couldn't bring the others into the process. Now, there was duplicity in the SOC position on this. The SOC did not reveal all their weapon holdings. They revealed the weapon holdings of the armies, but in fact it was in the nature of that society that the police force was essentially paramilitary, a very large military wing of government, and had sources of weapons which the Khmer Rouge kept talking about. But the idea of disarming the police force was not contained in the Paris agreements. If you talked to the Khmer Rouge, you would discover the suggestion that they found, because we didn't disarm the police, and we didn't disarm the SOC military effectively, that they could not disarm, because to disarm was to destroy themselves. There's some justification for the position that they take in this respect. There was a flaw in the Paris agreements with respect to the control of the Cambodian police force in particular, and it was never effectively brought under control. On the other hand, and I pleaded this to the Khmer Rouge on many occasions, is the only way we could get control of the state of Cambodia military wings was for them to give us a cooperation in various parts of the countryside, which I believe elements of their leadership understood fully, but because of the nature of the Khmer Rouge, they were unable to get that sort of compliance. So while they pleaded with us to bring the SOC under control more fully, they were unable to enable us to establish the conditions where that was possible. And that was the dilemma we were confronted with. So the SOC put 50,000 troops into the cantonments. Of the 180-odd or 200,000, I can't remember the exact figure that they revealed to us, they certainly weren't their prime troops they put into the cantonments, and certainly the weapon systems they put into the cantonments weren't their best weapons. You know, we were confronted with the idea that they were justified in not disarming because the Khmer Rouge stayed out in the countryside, and the Khmer Rouge were justified in not disarming because the Cambodian police and elements of their own military were not fully compliant with them, were not compliant with the process. Let me say that I think this is one of the most optimistic aspects of the Cambodian operation. We're talking about disengaging four military factions in an internal security environment. And that's an enormous undertaking, which in the sort of 6 months that was postulated for that was unrealistic. Nevertheless, it either had to be done quickly or not at all. And unfortunately, we were unable to get any but the two smaller factions to comply fully with this process.
Did you believe that your personal safety was threatened at any stage, and what precautions did you have to take?
Well, this is an interesting issue. I never had that sense of my personal safety being threatened. Of course, you know, I walked in the countryside and I travelled in the countryside, and the mine threat, which was the primary threat throughout the countryside, was always there. But I had a sense that my security was critical to the overall mission. So as the mission moved through, moved from one critical stage to a more critical stage, I raised the level of my security, not because for personal reasons, but for the safety of the mission. And as we got close to the election, it was clear that if anything happened to me, the election was not going to take place. And that was the time when I applied the greatest level of security to my movement around Cambodia.
And were there any occasions on which you believed UNTAC might need to resort to the use of force?
Well, I mean, the idea of the use of force was inherent in the Paris agreements and in the mandate. You see, what we were talking about is all of the military factions going through a great act of trust and placing themselves in the hands of the United Nations military component, moving into cantonments and disarming. Now, you cannot contemplate having responsibility for disarmed troops in cantonments if you can't protect them. And indeed, we had to write a set of standing operating procedures, which were a variation on normal UN standing operation procedures, to actually comprehend defending those people who were entrusted to us. How could it be any other way? Later on, it became necessary in order to sustain the confidence of the Cambodian people in the UN's intent and the electoral process for us to stay in various places. I mean, there were clearly activities conducted by the Khmer Rouge and maybe by the state of Cambodia to move the UN presence away from certain areas, either to deter the electoral process or in order to conduct other activities in those areas. And at a particular point in time, we had to make a statement that we would stay. And on a number of occasions, we fought what I would describe as company-level actions in order to make that point. particularly in the more remote areas. And in some cases, United Nations military people were killed in that activity. It was a deliberate act to say we are going to stay. And if we hadn't made it at those critical points, then we wouldn't have been able to conduct the election in those areas. And indeed, the electoral components, who were required to do their thing in this insecure environment, would have quickly collapsed in their confidence if the military had not been resistant in those places.
How effective were the NGOs in the peace-building process? How did they interact with the UNTAC military component?
The NGOs are a mixed bag. I think at some stage during our time there, we counted the 185 non-government organisations in Cambodia. Now, this extends from large international organisations such as the ICRC down to small contingents of one or two people representing small religious organisations in various parts of the world. And so the contribution was mixed. And in some cases, they were very vulnerable, very critical of the UN, formed a relationship with the media in their criticism, I think detracted from the UN presence there. The larger ones unquestionably had a major role to play. As always, the ICRC, the Scandinavian organisation, Red Barna, the organisations like CARE International, the larger groups made a very important contribution. And indeed were embraced quite comprehensively in the UN planning processes. All of this was part of the process of giving the Cambodians the confidence in the international community's commitment to their future. And indeed, as part of that confidence, engendering an attitude which would carry them to participate in this electoral act, which was the key issue. And the creation of an electorate in Cambodia and the actual courage of the Cambodian people to come forward and vote was the key issue in Cambodia, without any question. So the NGOs performed a very important part in that. But the relationship between the United Nations and the UN military component in particular and the NGOs was discordant. There were many NGOs who had an attitude that to have anything to do with the military would have detracted from their purpose. But we were constantly aware of their presence in the countryside, the problems of their security, and indeed, as I've said, their ability to actually detract from the international commitment to the military components operation. So since the Cambodian operation, I have been a strong proponent of the idea of a strategic alliance between the military and both the United Nations humanitarian agencies and the non-government organisations as a way to bring a resolution of these terrible problems that people suffer in these crisis-ridden countries.
What is your assessment of UNTAC's record on protecting human rights, and what was the effect of establishing a branch of the Human Rights Commission in Cambodia?
Well, first of all, let me explain myself as a firm adherent to the idea of individual rights and human rights as the fundamental basis of an effective justice system. And I have to tell you that there are a lot of people in the United Nations who don't have that firmness of conviction. I mean, they're more willing than others to sacrifice the rights of the individual for what are sometimes termed as individual rights or, in simple terms, stability. And it's interesting being in the United Nations because you see the full spectrum of attitudes towards this. Liberal Western attitudes don't prevail everywhere within the United Nations. In fact, they may be in a minority. But there's no question that even though there was little chance of getting full compliance with a liberal Western idea of human rights within Cambodia, that the presence of the Human Rights Commission, the human rights component of UNTAC, and the work that was done in establishing the rights of individuals in Cambodia was a key element in moving the Cambodian society and the Cambodian leadership in a direction which would not have been possible otherwise. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, you turn from left to right in this process, but you change the vectors and initiated a whole range of new thoughts in Cambodian society, which of course are the key to their future.
What could UNTAC do, if anything, about the mistreatment of the Vietnamese minority in Cambodia?
Well, constantly. I mean, we were in the process of trying to provide not a protective presence, but a presence throughout the countryside which deterred attacks on any minorities in Cambodia. And which deterred attacks on Cambodians themselves by members of their society. But the Vietnamese minority was a particular target of the Khmer Rouge and indeed other elements within Cambodian society, because Vietnam is seen as the eternal enemy of Cambodia. I think we have to understand that. It's much the same thing that's going on in the Balkans today, that Vietnamese are seen as having an encroaching, pervading presence in Cambodia, and Cambodians have a sense that their survival depends upon stemming the Vietnamese presence in Cambodia. So when the Khmer Rouge made attacks against Vietnamese civilians in Cambodia, they were not without some support from the rest of Cambodian society. Nevertheless, it was intolerable that the United Nations should be there and not do something about those attacks. And constantly, we provided a presence wherever we could, and constantly we did everything we could to sheet home the blame to where it lay. But we could not be everywhere within Cambodia. And neither were we involved in an enforcement operation in Cambodia. The mandate never, ever ascribed to the UNTAC military component an enforcement role, except in the sense of powers of arrest under a special prosecutor and a body of law. But we never had the enforcement role, and indeed, if we were to have moved to the enforcement role, I doubt if many of the contributors to UNTAC would have sustained their presence in the force.
And how would you evaluate the relationship between the military and the civilian components of UNTAC?
Well, I think it varied. But I think that it was, in United Nations terms, was as strong a relationship as it could be, and strengthened throughout the process. It became very clear that the operation was not feasible without a full commitment of the military component to both civil administration, logistic support, and the electoral activities in Cambodia. And indeed, Gérard Porcel, who was head of civil administration, the French head of civil administration, made this point very strongly when he said that with the movement of the military component's role from cantonment and disarmament to sustainment of the administrative and electoral processes in Cambodia, they unleashed a whole range of talent without which it would not have been possible to conceive of doing the sorts of things that had been done. And I think that realization is in fact a revelation to most of the civil components of the United Nations. It was reflected, I think, probably in the civic action area, which I'll speak about more later on, where the acknowledgement of a civil action role or civic action role for the military component only developed as the mission went on, despite the fact that we made the point that we really needed to do that right from the word go. I think the civil administration aspect of this revelation is quite interesting. I mean, the whole idea of border controls, immigration controls, controls of the flow of goods backwards and forwards across the border, the idea of control of the ports, the undertakings which were inherent in the United Nations mandate in Cambodia, were not feasible without many more people being applied to it than was planned for. And the only people who could do this was the military. So the military had to move into a relationship with the civil components which enabled these things to occur. Most of the work that was done in the ports, for example, and the harbours and the coastline was done by the military. And these are things that would normally be aspects of civil administration, immigration and control of flow of goods, control of ports, development of the operating safety mediums for ports and airfields, all done by the military, but within the civil framework.
You mentioned the civic action role for the military component. How important was that role?
Well, this is an absolutely vital role. I mean, for the last 50 years, militaries all over the world have been learning this lesson, that in order to create a favourable environment in which to sustain military operations of either a peacekeeping or a counterinsurgency nature, you must have a civic action program that goes hand in hand with it. Apart from the fact of creating a climate in which people are better disposed towards the military and have a greater sense of their own security, most of Cambodia was only accessible to the military. And therefore, if you wanted to conduct activities in support of Cambodian children, as UNESCO UNICEF wanted to do, or conduct activities in support of infrastructure development, as UNDP wanted to do, or conduct activities to support refugees, as UNHCR wanted to do, then you had to acknowledge that the military was going to play a large civic action role in those areas. In the early stages of the planning for UNTAC, I pleaded for a civic action budget for the military component, and I was told that that was none of our business, that it was the business of all the other humanitarian agencies and so on, and it wasn't feasible. Well, as it turned out, we came to a compromise with the agencies of our own accord in this, in that they provided the budgets and we provided the planning and the ingredients of a lot of the civic action programs. We were an agent of UNICEF, for example, in the delivery of water supplies in some of the more remote areas of Cambodia. And in doing that, this is well drilling and so on, and in doing that, we reinforced our own presence in the countryside and enhanced our access to the Cambodian people, and indeed enhanced their commitment to the process as well. So, absolutely vital, and the United Nations and the humanitarian agencies thereof have got to understand that the military is as vital to this role as they are.
To what extent was the authority of UNTAC respected with regard to the directive of 17 March 1993, which prohibited the possession and carrying of firearms?
Well, it's a nice piece of law, and the intent, I think, was praiseworthy, but the carriage of firearms in the Cambodian countryside was second nature, inherent in people's understanding of the environment in which they had to survive. However, there was a lot of indiscriminate use of weaponry by youths throughout the countryside, and this allowed the possibility of removing weapons from people who are behaving in an irresponsible manner. I want to say the idea that UNTAC could remove the weapons, I think, was a very encouraging idea for the Cambodian people, for the international community, and indeed for the civil components of UNTAC. But it wasn't a really feasible option for compliance in the time that was available without an effective police force throughout the countryside. I don't think we ever had an effective police force throughout the Cambodian countryside.
What was your assessment of the secessionist move of Prince Chakrapong just after the May 1993 election?
Well, first of all, let me say I think that Prince Chakrapong was a stooge in this. And let me also say that there had been a contingency plan on the part of the SOC to withdraw and run a government on the other side of the river as part of the fear of what might happen after the Vietnamese withdrawal. So this was an enactment of a contingency plan had been established for the post-89 environment after the Vietnamese withdrawal from the countryside. Chakrapong really was a stooge of this. There are other major players. The Samdek Irv Autonomous Zone, as it was called, in my mind was a ploy to generate an environment in Phnom Penh where the constitutional process would be compromised to allow a primary role for the losing party in the post-electoral environment. It certainly frightened a lot of people, so much so that there was a suggestion that the United Nations should withdraw from east of the Mekong, a suggestion which I resisted, and we sustained the military presence in those areas until there was a resolution of this. I actually, after a series of discussions, contemplated having to put people, a military force, east of the Mekong in order to provide for the security of our own people, including the military people, in the autonomous zone. And this was a very difficult thing to contemplate, but I, as a commander, I could not disregard the safety of people for whom I was responsible. But it would have been a very messy operation. The fact that we were planning such a thing, I made widely known to the Cambodian factions, and I think that that was conducive in bringing about a resolution of that particular problem.
What was your experience of dealings with the Thais, and what was your assessment of their objectives in Cambodia?
Well, quite clearly, the Thais had a number of objectives. First of all, it was to rid themselves of a difficult problem with respect to the refugees along the Thai-Cambodian border. Secondly, to do so in a way which sustained their interest in their claims to parts of Western Cambodia. Secondly, to provide in Phnom Penh a government which was favourable to their interests. And I think that, in fact, Prince Sihanouk was seen as being part of that. At the same time, of course, they were sustained by considerable economic interests along the Thai-Cambodian border, particularly in the gem trade, where a huge extraction of gems was taking place around the Palin area and further south of that. And also many Thais were engaged in the business of extracting timber from inside Cambodia. So there was a lot of money involved in this. So balancing up all their strategic interests, their geostrategic interests, their commercial interests, and so on, it was quite difficult for them to comply with all the requirements of the Cambodian operation, of the Cambodian mandate. And therefore, we found ourselves at times in a difficult relationship with the Thais, particularly with respect to the movement of military forces through Thailand to various parts of the Thai border. I'm now talking about Cambodian military forces. And on occasions, the presence of Thais inside Cambodia interfering with the economic processes there. You know, we worked our way through these relationships, and I think at times the feelings between Thailand and UNTAC were quite difficult. There was a desire on the part of the Thais to resolve these problems at a very local level, across the borders and regional terms. And while I was prepared to accede to the fact that a lot of problems could be solved on a local level, there was no doubt that the really serious issues had to be addressed to the United Nations and conducted at the international level. Otherwise, we would have been very vulnerable.
The decision not to try to disarm the Khmer Rouge, what was your thinking on this question?
Well, first of all, if the Khmer, the whole idea of the Paris agreements was that the factions fully complied with the agreements, and they came into the cantonments and they were secured in the cantonments, and then they disarmed. And if they didn't come into the cantonments, then you couldn't disarm them. It was as simple as that. It was no question of us going around the countryside trying to drag in Khmer Rouge and take their weapons off them. That would have been a full-scale war. And it's a nonsense for anybody to comprehend that it would be otherwise. So it wasn't a question of us saying we're not going to disarm the Khmer Rouge. The Khmer Rouge said, we're not going to come into the process until you comply with the following things. I recognised that if they weren't going to disarm, then there was no way we could disarm everybody else. And so I was intent on getting them to come into the process, and we kept the doors open for that as far and as long as we possibly could. But at the end of the day, and I read in some academic papers that the major failure of UNTAC was not to disarm the Khmer Rouge. This is a very simplistic and naive assessment of the nature of the agreement and what was possible in Cambodia. We tried to encourage the Khmer Rouge to be part of the process, in other words, to canton themselves under our supervision and allow us to disarm them. Anything else is ridiculous.
To what extent was Cambodia demilitarized, and how did this affect UNTAC's task?
Well, this is a very important question, and was the subject of a great deal of analysis on our part, because the answer to that question determined the extent to which we could be confident about conducting the electoral process in an insecure environment. Now, it's clear to us, it was clear to us, that the Khmer Rouge began to fall apart in 1989. That they'd conducted operations to lodge themselves back in Cambodia in anticipation of the Vietnamese withdrawal and to establish themselves as a major political factor inside Cambodia. And the same applied to the other resistance components, Phuong Chin Pek and the KPNLF. But with the loss of the Vietnamese enemy, a Cambodian government, albeit a puppet government in Phnom Penh, a lot of the vitality of the resistance cause disappeared. Not only that, a lot of the support for the resistance cause from the West and other places started to dissipate. We met a number of Khmer Rouge youths in the countryside who walked in and spoke constantly about when the war ended in 1989. All of the military factions were having great difficulty in holding their military components together. One reason was they couldn't pay them. I mean, the Khmer Rouge had a much better capacity to pay their soldiers than the state of Cambodia did. Quite clearly, as a vibrant military force, all of them had frittered away. Nevertheless, the countryside was full of unemployed soldiers who couldn't see their way forward into a future employment. And that was the great security threat. A beggar with an AK-47 is a very persuasive beggar, and they were everywhere. So, to my great regret, we had quite a limited capacity to demilitarize the countryside once the Khmer Rouge had decided that they were not going to comply with the Paris Agreements. And they saw that quite clearly. I mean, this was the tool that they employed in order to get concessions from the United Nations, which were outside the Paris Agreements. The Paris Agreements, as I said, were also inconclusive about the demilitarization of the police. And there was the illusion that the police were somehow a Western-style police organization which operated in the interests of the people in normal policing duties, instead of being a paramilitary force armed to the teeth, in most instances, better armed and better paid than the military forces and the great threat. So there's the flaw, and it did have a profound effect on UNTAC's task. But as I've already said, we changed the focus of the military, changed the structure or the dispositions of the military, and went at the UNTAC task with a will. And the UNTAC task was essentially to allow the enfranchisement of the Cambodian population and the conduct of an election.